their generation is the ones who are mostly responsible for this crisis, and we need to hold them accountable. We need to hold the people in power accountable for what they have been doing to us and future generations and other living species on Earth. And we need to get angry and understand what is at stake, and then we need to transform that anger into action and to stand together united and just never give up.
So that's 16-year-old Greta Thunberg, who will be here in New York as one of the leaders of the climate strike here, as we also talk to leaders all over the country. That does it for our roundtable, but certainly not our coverage. Shia Bastida, thank you for joining us here in New York, and Katie Eder, Jerome Foster II as well in Washington, who together with Isra Hirsi, all of you will be at the UN Youth Climate Summit on Saturday. I want to thank Kelsey Juliana and Juwaria John. And Nasratullah Elham. Yes, you couldn't be here in person, but we broke the sound barrier with your voice from Phuket, Thailand, denied a visa to come to that Youth Climate Summit. But the activism is happening everywhere. Follow our Twitter feed at Democracy Now! We'll be bringing you a special on the actions over the weekend on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. To see our full discussion with Greta Thunberg, go to democracynow.org.
Listener-supported non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, winner of the Spirit of College Radio Award.
From now until September 26th, the Sisson Gallery at Henry Ford College is having an album cover art exhibition, a window on world culture and art history. The Sisson Gallery is located in the Fine Arts Center building at Henry Ford College, 5101 Evergreen Road in Dearborn. It is open Monday to Thursday, 9 to 4:30 p.m. For more information, call 313-845-6485 or sglazer@hfcc.edu. This exhibition is free to the public. See you there.
Swimming pools can be lots of fun, but they can be dangerous too, especially for young children. Always practice simple safety steps to prevent tragedies. Fence all pools. Teach kids to swim. And always watch them around water.
No horseplay.
Simple steps save lives. To learn new life-saving steps, visit poolsafely.gov. A public service message from the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission.
WHFR has brand new buttons, and we want you to have one for free. We are going old school with this promotion. Simply send us a postcard. Yeah, a real-life postcard with your name and address, too. WHFR Attention Buttons, 5101 Evergreen Road, Dearborn, Michigan, 48128. Let us know if you like blue or black better.
This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw. So great to be with you this Friday afternoon, and we appreciate our loyal listeners being here at 89.3 and also WHFR.fm. We've got a very busy show ahead, don't we?
We sure do. Looking forward to talking to a representative from the AAUW, American Association of University Women, about their big book sale coming up next week, and then we're going to get into a little bit on why reading is so important. But before
I just gotta say it. Yeah.
Please do. He's such a teacher, isn't he? I love it. When we get into the idea of other things that are very important, now we all love to curl up with a good book and kind of stow away in our little corner of the world. But you know, there are other corners of the world, actually corners of our own community, that are maybe they
need a lot more help.
Yeah,
don't they?
not doing so well, or ways that we can improve. So our first segment today, we'll discuss that very topic. We are Today we are wrapping up the big forum, the environmental climate change forum
exactly. Here at HFC. Yes,
and today is sort of the official walkout for climate change and so on in so many universities around the country, around the world, in fact. So it's a big day to talk about being kind to helping and hopefully reversing the negative, harmful effects that we as humans are doing upon this planet. And as Henry Ford College has so famously been known over the years, Alan, as HFC, Harvard on the Rouge. We've always called it that.
Yeah. I've heard that once or twice.
I just love it. We thought we'd bring in the head of the Friends of the Rouge, actually, to help us kind of figure all this out. So we're joined via phone by Marie McCormick, who is the executive director of the wonderful organization Friends of the Rouge, located sort of officially out of Plymouth, Michigan, but we've got the Rouge going through our backyard, so we claim stake to it as well. Marie, welcome to our show. We're so happy to talk to you today.
Thank you so much, Susan. I'm so happy to be here, too.
Awesome. Well, we have always heard good things about Friends of the Rouge getting out, helping to clean up the Rouge. It's always the Rouge River cleanups and so on. But in light of a very big 50th anniversary of a very special and interesting event going on, we're going to lead to that in just a little bit, we thought a reintroduction might be appropriate. So if you would, Friends of the Rouge, we know, is a nonprofit organization, been around for 30-something years, I think, at this point. And tell us a little bit about your mission. And really why you and the Friends are here.
Well, thanks, Susan, for the introduction. So Friends of the Rouge is a 501c3 nonprofit. We were founded in 1986 to raise awareness about the need to clean up the Rouge River in southeast Michigan. And our mission is to restore, protect, and enhance the Rouge River watershed through stewardship, education, and collaboration. And we were originally formed, as I mentioned, in the mid-80s, as a sort of grassroots group that really helped to pull trash out of the river and sort of galvanize volunteers to get out and do something in a really sort of boots-on-the-ground fashion. The organization has sort of matured over the years. We not only continue to do that work through our signature event, Rouge Rescue, which we just held in May, but we also do other types of stewardship activities. We have a 30-some-year-old education program that we run. We do different types of monitoring, including fish, toad, and frog, and as well as bug surveys. And we also do, we've most recently been working on a water trail that runs through the 11 communities in the Lower Rouge. It's a 27-mile water trail. And it actually passes right by the Henry Ford Community College. So we're excited about that trail and looking to the future for a more improved Rouge River.
When you say Rouge watershed, give us the scope of what this watershed is, because I grew up in West Detroit, right around Tyreman and Evergreen. And obviously, when we saw the Rouge River, we thought of Rouge Park. And I remember going for walks back there when it was very, very littered. And I'm talking, the mid-70s or so. I live in Wyandotte now, so we see Ecorse Creek. We see, obviously, the Rouge River emptying into the Detroit River. How far up does it go, and what is the scope of, Friends of the Rouge?
Sure. Thanks for asking. The Rouge watershed is an area of land drained by the river. So it's a kind of, I think of it like a bowl, and all the edges are draining down to the middle or a low point. And in our case, it's a river, the Rouge River. Mm-hmm. But our watershed drains 467 square miles. Wow. It has four major branches. We call them the main, upper, middle, and lower, with 127 river miles and over, I think it's pretty close to 570 river miles, which includes the tributaries.
What would be the furthest north or west point where this Rouge, watershed becomes in play?
The furthest north point would be, I guess it would be like Birmingham, Bloomfield wow. Hills. It kind of goes over to Wixom, South Lyon, if you can imagine like imaginary line drawing. Mm-hmm. Over to Northville, Plymouth, down to Canton, actually part of Romulus, kind of swoops over to Dearborn Heights and rounds out to kind of River Rouge, Allen Park, and then up to Dearborn. And then Southfield's kind of the furthest north central border as
You're covering a lot of our listening area, and that's why I asked the question, because it's important to all of us who live and work here. So
that's amazing.
Absolutely.
Marie, when we talk about sort of how the organization kind of what it was meant to do when it got started all the way to where it is today, why do you think the change, the morphing kind of has taken place? I know as a younger person, my experience with Friends of the Rouge really was going to the Rouge rescues, the Rouge cleanups every year. We'd pick the straws out of the out of the river and clean things up. And now, unfortunately, we're still having to do some of that today.
I was going to say, car tires.
Things that unmentionables. But because, things have changed and grown so much, still, of course, we have that underlying issue of making and keeping our areas clean, of course. So I don't know that's changed and improved. But is it kind of like the more people you brought in, the more power you were able to mass to do more things? Is that kind of how this grew and got to where you are today?
I think that Friends of the Rouge played a role, but we're just one of many organizations that have done a lot to improve the Rouge. And I think, it happens at the grassroots and the grass tops level. So in 1985, right before the Friends of the Rouge was started, the Rouge River was designated as one of 43 Great Lakes Areas of Concern. We call them AOCs, because of significant impairment in this particular watershed. And it led to the formation of, we call it the RRAC, but the Rouge River Advisory Council. And it helped funnel in literally millions and millions of dollars into our area. A lot of that was led by the late Congressman John D. Dingell. And I think some of it, the impetus really was because of that fire that I mentioned earlier, or that you kind of mentioned earlier, but and the Clean Water Act that was passed in 1972.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And so you're thinking like grass tops and then grassroots kind of merging the two. Because you can't really have one without the other if you want to have, like, really big watershed-wide change. We've had funding from the Great Lakes Legacy Act, from the AOC funding, from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which you may have just heard a little bit about. Recently, Senator Stabenow and Senator Peters have announced an initiative to increase the funding. Right now, it's about $300 million a year, and that covers all the Great Lakes states, all eight of them, plus Canada. And that funding has been imperative in helping to improve the Rouge and a lot of the other impaired waterways across our state and the region. So
you've mentioned the word Great Lake or the words Great Lakes several times in there. Just the whole concept of, the Rouge being part of this entire watershed. And there are a lot of, concerns going on there in terms of water being diverted from the Great Lakes watershed. And then we hear stories about how, water levels are high. This is a very important part of, sort of like keeping things clean downstream, but also being a part of this larger picture of really, truly, the most fresh water in literally on planet Earth, right?
Great Lakes account for 20% of the total fresh water, surface water on planet Earth. So we have a precious resource here. And, I think some groups are doing a lot to protect it. And then on the flip side, there's some powers at large that may be doing things to damage it. So we continually see improvements, but we still have some watershed threats that we have to kind of come to terms with, from flooding to stream bank erosion. We still have combined sewer overflows that are prevalent in Dearborn and Detroit areas, illegal discharges, continued loss of wildlife habitat with rapid suburbanization. And then, of course, you have invasive species to contend with, whether it's through dirty ballast water or bringing things in by land. So those are, just some short list of watershed threats that we have that are still kind of things that we're working on and working to address.
Do we take these things for granted? here in Michigan in terms of the fresh water. You know, if you look around the country, and obviously as we head into, you know, the later 21st century, this, you know, idea of fresh water is going to be a big issue nationwide. You know, obviously, I think you've already expressed how we need to protect it and you know, and conserve it for, you know, not only ourselves, but that's from the selfish perspective, but for humanity as well.
Yeah, for future generations. I think it's funny you say that, because a lot of other parts of our country think about water quantity, when in the Great Lakes area, we think more about water quality because we have so much quantity. But, you know, you still continually have outside parties who are looking to stick a straw in the, you know, in the pool. And the more straws there are, the more, the less we have here. So I say to the people who move to Arizona, if you want water, just move back to Michigan.
That's great advice. Marie McCormick is joining us. She's the executive director of Friends of the Rouge, a nonprofit organization working to do so many things, but most importantly, to raise awareness about the need to clean up the Rouge River in southeast Michigan. And that's why we are talking to her. Now, let's do a little history lesson here. So this year is the 50th anniversary of a pretty big thing that kind of took a made everything sort of stop and turn, and we're going in a direction now. And that's the Rouge River Fire of 1969. It kind of makes me think of like the Chicago Fire with the lady in the barn and all that.
I was going to say the Cuyahoga River.
The Cuyahoga, oh, there you
that's,
go.
That's the one we all know. But
that's
let's,
right, that's
let's
right.
go through the history of this.
Yeah, let's talk about this. What sure. Why is this event important, Marie? And tell us, for those that have no knowledge of this whatsoever, what was this about?
What happened? Okay, so on October 9th, 1969, right near the Rouge plant in Zug Island, sparks from an acetylene torch ignited oil and woody debris in the Rouge River. And so there were flames 50 feet in the air. They employed 10 pieces of Detroit Fire Department equipment. 65 men fought the fire. And so I think, as you guys mentioned earlier, the Cuyahoga and the Chicago, the burning Rouge River, with others of its time, really symbolized the peak of societal indifference to pollution. And they were essentially accepted as the cost of doing business. That's just how it was. But I think this historic fire, amongst the other ones, became a catalyst for the transformation of the watershed. So it drew public and political attention to this environmental crisis and really inspired legislation like the Clean Water Act of 1972, led by the late Congressman John D. Dingell, to kind of push for, you know, total and complete transformation of all these, you know, collective watersheds. But I think what's notable is the Rouge River, amongst a lot of the others I mentioned, the Cuyahoga in particular, you know, businesses are returning to the river. It's an economic driver. It's this redevelopment is an incredible story of revitalization and renewal and rebirth of these different kinds of Rust Belt rivers that had such a dark history and are returning to life. So, you know, these regional assets really took collaborative efforts, both politically from all the participating municipalities, businesses, private citizens, and nonprofits, just like Friends of the Rouge, to make this happen. Yeah.
And what kind of example do we serve here in the Great Lakes region for other issues that are going on? We think about, you know, opening up the North Slope of Alaska for drilling and the environmental issues that it might bring. You know, what kind of opportunities do we have to show that we don't have to go down that path?
Well, I think, you know, I think about it this way. In the Rouge watershed, you have some of the biggest chunks of industry, you know, in the country. Look at Zug Island and the Rouge Turning Basin and the complex there. I think the industry and the things that we think about in terms of our needs as society, or modern needs, we'll say, they don't have to come at the cost of the environment anymore. We have the type of technology and the wherewithal and the foresight to know when something's a good idea and something's not. And, you know, at this point, we live with that type of industry as a reality of our everyday. But I think
it makes our lives possible, really. I mean, we have to admit
that,
right?
Yeah, you really want to make sure that if that's really something that you think is a sustainable long-term choice. And, you know, we got to think about that, not just for the next 5 years, not for the next 20, but the next 100, 200, 300 years. How is that going to affect future generations?
Yeah. Well, there's a way for those of us that are interested and wanting to help, wanting to participate in some way to help contribute to Friends of the Rouge. And I know everybody kind mm-hmm. of does things their own way, but to sort of commemorate, I want to celebrate, to commemorate the Rouge fire, the Rouge River fire, you have an event coming up on October the 10th to kind of help mark this anniversary. Tell us how we can mm-hmm. get involved and what's going on with this.
Well, we have a really exciting event happening. It's going to be at Marine Pollution Control, MPC, and they're a group that was formed actually 50 years ago, and they do a lot of the environmental remediation, not only in the area, but nationally. And we're hosting our event at their headquarters. It's right on the Rouge River, overlooking Zug Island, which is completely appropriate. And this event will be held from 4 to 9 p.m., We will have keynote speaker Martin Doyle. He's the author of a book called The Source, How Rivers Made America and America Remade Its Rivers. And we'll also have remarks from Dr. John Hartig. He's the author of the book Burning Rivers, as well as a recent book that was published and is being promoted called Waterfront Porch, Reclaiming Detroit's Industrial Waterfront as a Gathering Place for All. We will have live entertainment with jazz quartet straight ahead. We'll have a visit from the Detroit Fireboat Engine 16, the Curtis Randolph, which visitors will actually be able to board and tour the boat. We'll also have boat tours for guests. We'll take them on a little mini tour of the old channel around Zug Island so they can have a look at the EPA and Honeywell-funded Great Lakes Legacy Act sediment cleanup project that's happening there. Very interesting. There, of course, will be an open bar with all Michigan craft beer and wine. And we'll actually have a special event edition brew from Downey Brewing Company.
Wow.
So we're excited about the event. We have additional dignitaries who may be speaking as well, but I am not at liberty to announce those at this time. So I'm excited to announce that soon.
I'm always curious to know how somebody that's in a position such as yours as executive director of this organization, you know, what got you to the place that you are serving this constituency? I don't know why in some way I want to say like marine biology or something like that, or totally unrelated to the science side of it. Maybe you're more into the people person kind of thing. But what's your story,
yeah,
Marie?
Yeah. That's funny. Thanks for asking that. So I grew up in Northville, Michigan, so in the western edge of the Rouge watershed. I grew up at a time when Northville was not developed. I grew up downtown, and I grew up while watching all of the forests and all of the farmland get developed into subdivisions. So that was a really big impact that took a big toll on me. I already had a very strong relationship with the natural world, and watching it get leveled and cleared was very impactful to me. My background is in writing and literature and communications. I did get my master's in sustainable community development with a focus in botany. And then I have a professional certificate in nonprofit management. But my passion has always been the environment, but and I do have a background in hard science and botany, but I think it sort of transcended just the science part in recognizing that I couldn't live in a lab coat to actually make meaningful change. I think it really had to be something that was engaging community in both, as I mentioned, grass tops and grassroots level, and thinking about things in a holistic, long-term vision way. I felt was my path to making the most impact.
And following up on that, are there opportunities when it comes to cleanups and things like that for children, for that next generation to get involved?
Absolutely. We have a couple of different programs that I think are great for kids as an entryway and families. The first one is doing the Frog and Toad Survey, which is a listening survey. We do a one-hour training with you and your family, and then you get assigned a section of the watershed to go out and literally listen for the presence or absence of frogs and toads. We also do bug surveys. Now we do them twice a year. We do one called the Stonefly Search, and one is the Fall Bug Hunt, which is actually coming up. And that's a way to, we have trained volunteers who actually take groups out, and we get in the river and you scoop out the bottom and you put them in, ice trays, and you identify the different bugs in there. And then you count them. So you look at the different bugs in there. We call them indicator species. So they help tell a story about the health of the water. And so if there's certain kinds of bugs, it tells you whether or not the water quality is good. Some insects have a two-year life cycle. So if you have more sensitive species in there, you know that the water quality is good. And that's a fun way and really low-impact way for families to get involved. And it only takes a couple hours of your time. We also do Rouge Rescue every year, and that's in May. And we usually have 30 sites across the watershed, so there's always something close to your home. And, you know, we have volunteer opportunities for people from cleaning up trash to removing invasive species to checking people in, being a greeter. There are things for young children all the way to elderly who may not want to do physical labor. So we have a lot of opportunities for that sort of entry level. And then we also have opportunities for people who are interested in becoming a more skilled volunteer, whether it's with our Rouge Education Program, as a bug hunt leader, you know, doing fish surveys. There's many, many opportunities. So it's kind of what's in your wheelhouse that we can most likely accommodate.
I know what's not in my wheelhouse, the bugs in the ice trays.
No, seriously, Susan. That's the fun stuff,
okay.
Right?
It's all yours.
It really is fun.
Marie, we look forward to hearing more about that maybe in the spring when you're getting ready for the cleanup and things like that. And for those of us who live sort of in the other end of that watershed in Wyandotte, we appreciate all your efforts to keep things clean. One more time, Susan, if you want to give us or have her give us the information about the event coming up.
Yeah, if you would. Again, we're looking at the October 10th event. Sounds like a wonderful, wonderful experience all the way around. Mm-hmm. And if somebody wants to get tickets for this specifically, Marie, or if they just want to learn more about this organization, how might they get in touch?
If you'd like tickets for the event or learn more about Friends of the Rouge, please visit us at www.therouge.org.
Easy enough. Well, we are grateful for your efforts and the entire organization's and also for your time today. We will let you move on to do bigger and better things, but we appreciate this and look forward to getting as many of our community listeners to sort of put on that hat of volunteer in some capacity. So thanks again. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you so much. You too.
Thanks, Marie.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back with more on the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw on the station Making Waves.
This is the WHFR Journal. Welcome back. Susan McGraw here along with Alan Mazurek. And we are fortunate to be joined in studio for the first time ever, can't believe that's the case, with our own Pam Stewart. Pam is an English language instructor here at Henry Ford College. And in this particular interview, she's going to be wearing a different hat. And this is the hat of a representative of the coolest organization called the AAUW, American Association of University Women. The minute I say that, I think books, and rightly so. Pam, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Susan.
It's a pleasure to have you here. We tend to associate the AAUW with the big book sales that are going on. I know it's so much more than that, certainly. So many more facets of this organization. But let's start books, shall we? We've got a book fair, book sale coming up literally next week.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about what we can expect.
Sure. So the members and also very generous people in the community that donate books for us to sell at the sale are prepping for us to open the doors at the Dearborn Ice Skating Center, the DISC on Ford Road, next next Thursday, September 26th. The sale opens at 11 o'clock in the morning and will close at 7 p.m. You can walk in. Entry is free. And once inside, you'll move upstairs. You'll find a very nice selection of books, both hardcover, softcover books, music. We do have a special collection of older books. And you can browse to your heart's content. There are people there to help you if you want assistance. The books and the materials are organized by genre. And the funds that we earn from the sale, which will run through Sunday till 3 p.m. on Sunday, September 29th, are used to fund some of the issues that are important to our organization, which our organization, we are the local branch, the Dearborn branch of the AAUW, and our mission is really to advance gender equity for women and girls through research, education, and advocacy.
When you say DISC, are we talking about the what many Dearborners would call the Mike Adrey Arena there by Greenfield, or
correct, Alan?
Okay.
Yes, yeah.
Now called the DISC.
Sure.
Now,
yes,
now it's called the DISC. Yeah, Lots of acronyms.
I'm not. Yeah, exactly. I'm not a Dearborn resident myself, but that's kind of like historically what we remember. So Ford Road, just east of Greenfield.
Correct.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah, I think one of the most exciting parts about a book sale such as this is just the opportunity to go, to spend an hour. You know, you expect you're going to go in for 20 minutes, and 3 hours later, you're still looking through books. And you welcome that, and you encourage that. The ability to just walk through, browse. I like to pick up a good old book and smell it, and then look through it. I know that's weird, but I can't help it. And just kind of get lost in the experience, which clearly supports the very lofty but very profound mission that the AAUW has to begin with, and it's about education and it's about equity, as you indicated, but it's like all books are created equal at this particular event because they all have pretty similar price tags, yes?
Yes, we do. It's pretty simple. Any hardcover is $2, and the soft covers are $1. The exception to that would be, again, like the rare book collection that we also do offer for people who are looking for something a little bit more special. And there is no pressure to buy. You can come in and browse around. In fact, if you do so, you'll probably run into not only Henry Ford faculty, because we do have a fair number of faculty and staff here who are able to squeeze in some time to volunteer to work at the book sale, but also a whole cross-section of the Dearborn community, other AAUW members who are retired teachers from Dearborn K-12 district, people who have worked in other capacities in the Dearborn area who also step up and give their time to support this sale.
Great. Are we talking thousands of books? Are we at tens of thousands of books yet? Because I know it's huge, just huge. It's the biggest book sale I ever go to.
Yes. Anywhere. Yeah, there are a lot. We're full right now, to be honest. The former Adrey Ice Skating Center, Dearborn Ice Skating Center, has been really...
Sorry I had to mention it, but I just wanted...
Well, it's important to make the connection because
correct.
Some people know it is the Mike Adrey. They've been very kind, very generous to us. They offer us free storage for all of these books, like from year to year. And this is our big sale, but we do also, just I think because of the sheer volume of what we have to sell. The last couple of years, we've also run kind of a smaller sale in June. So I was not a part of that this year. I don't recall what I was doing, possibly teaching in early June. But so everyone at the center is very kind and very helpful with respect to, you know, tucking these things away at the end of the sale and then keeping them in storage for us. Because you'll notice if you're in Dearborn and if you're shopping at different locations around the city, you might see something that almost looks like a rain barrel or some kind of an old barrel, and there'll be a sign, donate your books to AAUW. Some of our members, there is a committee that does travel around the city at regular intervals, and they do empty those barrels, and then they're deposited over at the DISC. And every Tuesday morning, there is a committee throughout the year of individuals that meet, I think around maybe 10 or 11 a.m., and they help to sort those donations and to get them stored. We do try to keep things as organized as possible, so that when it's time to open up for one of the book sales, it's not a crazy free-for-all.
Right.
So this is a year-long process, right, in terms of preparing for this weekend. And as you mentioned, you did a summer or spring or summer sale last year.
It never ends.
When we talk about the money that's raised at an event like this, and this, I'm assuming, probably one of the biggest fundraisers that the AAUW puts on every year, maybe the biggest, could you provide an example, Pam, of maybe something that those funds might go towards in supporting? And I should mention, Pam has been kind enough to join us today. She is not an official book sale chair, so we don't want to ask too much of you, but
sure.
I know you've been an AAUW member here, and I'm sure can very, very comfortably speak about the organization. So what are the types of things that this money is going towards?
Sure. We do have various committees within our local Dearborn AAUW branch, and we use the money. We'll get together to meet to decide how do we want to to give back. We do fund students both here at Henry Ford College and next door at University of Michigan Dearborn that choose to attend the Nick Whistle Conference. Don't ask me about that acronym because I don't recall. But it is a national conference, and it's something that advances our mission and allows students to attend, perhaps, you know, college students registered here at Henry Ford or U of M Dearborn, their first professional conference where they're able to engage in, like, leadership sessions and have interaction with not only, you know, senior, I guess, AAUW members, but lawmakers in Washington. That mm-hmm. conference happens in Washington. We also support other local groups within Dearborn, the Youth Symphony, Friends of the Dearborn Library, and I know that there are others that are escaping me right now, but we do also send money out to those organizations. Mm-hmm.
And what are the criteria to become a member of AAUW, and are you looking for new people?
Sure. Definitely yes to the last question. If you are a college student enrolled anywhere on any college campus, you definitely qualify as a student member. And anyone else who possesses at minimum an associate's degree, we welcome your membership and your participation.
Very good. Ellen, have you seen this movie? It's the Woody Allen film from, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, Midnight in Paris. Are you familiar with that one?
I did see that
okay.
one. Is that Owen Wilson?
Yes,
that was
the Owen
okay,
Wilson.
Yeah, just trying
fantastic.
To place it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, yeah.
Pam, if you haven't seen this movie, I highly recommend it. Okay. It's fantastic. It's got a book theme. It's the scenario is, and I literally watched this last night, so it's,
okay.
This was my research for the interview. Yeah, it's this writer in you know, the now, in the modern time, and he has this experience where he's taken back into Paris in the heyday of the F. Scott Fitzgeralds and the Ernest
20s,
Hemingways.
Early
and
30s. Yeah,
yeah, that sort of rowdy
between the wars,
time.
So
exactly,
yes,
exactly.
Correct.
And he gets to meet his favorite writers, and they share all these literary, you know, wonderful experiences and sort of mindfulness as it relates to writing and the creative side of getting in touch with what's inside of you and so on and so forth. And I was thinking about the book sale, and I was thinking, gee, sometimes I just go and I just think the covers are pretty and I want to put them on my coffee table. That makes me a very shallow book sale purchaser. But
no.
But at the same time,
so
we have kind of sort of something for everybody, I guess we'll
yes.
put it that way. So speak to that a little bit.
I know people who do the same thing at the wine store. Just if the bottle looks pretty, it's
go.
Got to be good. Yeah,
there
go
you
ahead.
Go.
Yeah, continue.
Well, you know, if you think about who doesn't have Pinterest now, mm-hmm. and we have our boards for decoration, mm-hmm. for motivation, for exercise, for eating. And I actually do have a page with decorating with text, so uh-huh. books. So there are all sorts of things you can do. I mean, there's never a bad reason to buy a book, to borrow a book, to acquire a book, as long as it doesn't involve making someone else sad because you're taking it without their
mm-hmm.
knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
No, I love books. I do love books. I love the physicality of them. And I do prefer to read on paper, which I suppose makes me a bit of a dinosaur, maybe. But
that's a little harsh because from one dinosaur to another, I think. Yeah, so we need to think of a nicer word for that. But exactly, you know, the light-on-light reading on the flat tablet just has never quite worked for me.
Vintage. We'll call ourselves vintage.
I like
that.
Vintage spirits, yeah. That works well. Well, we are so excited to help get the word out about this event, about the AAUW in general? I know there was a holiday tea, or not a holiday tea, but a tea that went. So there are some social things that happen, too, throughout the season. So is it kind of like, as a member, you can sort of do as much or as little as your schedule will allow?
You can. Okay. In fact, I do have a fall calendar, which I'd be happy to share with anyone. If you do visit the Dearborn-mi.aauw.net website, you can access that fall calendar. You can come and talk with me. I'm in the K building in room 236. I'd be happy, even if you just wanted to check it out and were curious, you can come as my guest. We can attend something and we can talk.
So Dearborn-mi.aauw.net?
Yes, you
okay.
Got it.
Very good. Okay. Just
yes.
Making sure we know.
Great.
Okay.
And I know that all of our AAUW volunteers are going to be very busy again, even for the next several days and next weekend. Forget it. You know,
salvage.
Lots going
yeah.
on. Yeah, there you go. Do you, is there a direct way we might reach you? Should there be just one specific burning question that somebody can't find on the website?
Sure. Probably the best way you could contact me would be through email. And my email is pcaminski@hfcc.edu. If I don't know the answer, I'll connect you with someone who does.
Very good. We're so excited about this event. We wish you continued success with all the wonderful things that the AAUW is doing. And in addition, again, this is not, I don't say just a local branch, but one of so many. Is this an international organization, quite
it
proudly?
Is. Yes, it is. So. Yep. It was founded in 1881. The headquarters, I guess the mothership, if you want to refer to it that way, is located in Washington, D.C.
And this came about just to, obviously, even at that point, and we're going back, what, 140 years or mm-hmm. so, elevate the status of women in the educational environment, I assume.
Certainly. And I even think just in the world. I mean, if we think about women's reality at that time, women did not have the kind of opportunities that we do today with respect not only to education, but just about controlling their lives and bodies. So without getting too political here, you know, a lot has changed in 140 years.
Well, 140 years later, we take a lot of things for granted, but there is still, you know, there is still the need for those opportunities that people might not have. And that's why something like the AAUW is important, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And certainly awareness, too. Sometimes it's easier to appreciate where we are when we know sort of where we came from.
Where we started.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Well, keep up the good work. We really appreciate your time. Don't be a stranger. You know where we live now. So come over and see us anytime, of course. We thank you for your time. And again, for more information, it's dearborn-mi.aauw.net. The big AAUW book sale starting Thursday the 26th, going all the way through Sunday the 29th. And on that date, it will close at 3 p.m. And it's going to be, you know, I want to say just a frenzy of excitement and energy and knowledge, but the good stuff goes fast, so start early.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, very good. Well, we look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you, Susan.
Okay, thanks. We've got more to come right here. This is the WHFR Journal. Please stay with us.
Do we have an obligation to be moral? How do we even know what is right or wrong?
Do we really have free will, or are the choices we make the result of causes and effects beyond our control?
Is my mind or soul a separate thing from my body, or just a function or product of my brain?
Are these the type of questions that interest you? Do you want to develop your skills in reasoning? Then you should check out the courses in philosophy that are offered at Henry Ford College. Philosophy deals with big perennial questions that keep cropping up each generation because they are too big for one person or generation to answer completely. It is a quest to find the fundamental truths about our lives and our world through critical thinking. Henry Ford College regularly offers the following courses:
Introduction to Philosophy,
Introduction to Logic,
History of Philosophy,
Ethics, and Eastern Philosophy.
These courses will help you earn your degree and will help shape your thought for the rest of your life. For more information about the philosophy courses at Henry Ford College, look online at hfcc.edu or contact Professor Ryan Scholler at rshowler@hfcc.edu.
Hope Village Farmers Market has partnered with the Michigan Farmers Market Association, a nonprofit, member-based statewide association on a mission to advance farmers markets to create a thriving marketplace for local food and farm products. For fresh local produce, vegan food, children's activities, beautiful gardens, yoga in the park, and more. Stop by Hope Village Farmers Market at 14150 Woodrow Wilson at Oakland Boulevard, Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m. Visit Facebook.com/MyHopeVillage for more information. Support your local farmers.
Please join WHFR.FM 89.3 for blues music on Highway 61, Friday 2 till 4 p.m. Each week, DJ Kitty Love brings the best in new blues releases and Detroit blues to Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR.
Welcome back to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw. So glad to have you with us for this Friday afternoon. And we're going to wrap up our program, sort of following up on our last segment. We're so glad to have Pam Stewart from the American Association of University Women, and also an English instructor here at Henry Ford College, stop by to talk about the AAUW's book sale coming up. Well, so let's see why we had that on the air and talk about why reading matters. This comes to us from TED Talk. Every once in a while, we like to round out our program exploring some different topics. And this one is a talk simply entitled Why Reading Matters by Rita Carter. It was given last summer at TEDx in Cluj, Romania. According to Rita, speaking is already in our genes, but reading is not. Reading 30 pages of fiction every night gets neural pathways thicker and thicker and helps work out our brains just like our body. She's a writer, broadcaster, and journalist who specializes in the workings of the human brain. Her books include The First Layman's Guide to Neuroscience, Mapping the Mind, which has been translated into 14 languages. Why Reading Matters, Rita Carter talking at a TED Talk in Romania here on the WHFR Journal.
Came and told you that there was just one thing you could all do which would make you more imaginative, make your memory better, probably improve your personal relationships, and make you a nicer person. You would probably be very skeptical, and even more so if I said it costs nothing, and probably everybody in this room can already do it. Now, you will probably have guessed by now that I'm talking about reading. There is a clue in the title. But I'm not talking about the sort of reading that we all know is incredibly important. That is, the sort of reading we do for education, the sort of reading we do for administration, the sort of reading which we have to do nowadays just to get through life. I'm talking rather about fiction, stories, narratives. The sort of reading where you are reading things from inside another person's head, where it takes you right inside the character's emotions and feelings and actions, so you are seeing it from their perspective. That's the sort of reading which is at best thought of as pleasurable and at worst quite often as a waste of time. I mean, I remember my mother telling me that when she was a child she was crazy about books, but that her father once ripped a novel out of her hands, saying that if you have to read, at least read something useful. Well, what I want to tell you today is that, surprisingly, fiction is very useful indeed in ways that we probably never previously suspected. In fact, it's more important probably than any other form of reading. And I have some new evidence which comes rather surprisingly out of the brain sciences to support that, which I'll come to. First of all, some not so new evidence. In 2013, there was a series of experiments. It was done by two New York psychologists, David Kidd and Emmanuel Castano. What they did was take people and ask them to read quite short passages from various types of books. Some of them were non-fiction books, explanatory or learning books, Some of them were sort of thrillers, plots, where you read about events happening in a story, but not very much about the people. You weren't inside their heads. And the third sort was the sort of fiction I am talking about, which is when you were reading things from the perspective of the characters. After that, the researchers got the people to look at a series of photographs of people with fairly strong facial expressions of one sort or another. And they were asked to judge from the expressions alone what they thought was going on inside those people's heads. This is actually quite a standard test for something that we call theory of mind, which is a bad phrase, I think, for a faculty which we're all, I hope, pretty familiar with. We've all got it to some extent or another. And that is the intuitive ability to see from the way a person is moving or expressing themselves what is going on in their head. It allows us to, just at least for a moment, to step outside our own heads and see the world for a bit from other people's point of view. And the same faculty, by extension, opens our whole worlds to us because it allows us to imagine what it's like to be somewhere else, doing something else, seeing it in a different way. And thus, people who don't have it are quite severely handicapped, particularly in social life. They find relationships very difficult. And more than that, they are limited by a very limited imagination. Because without that ability to step outside yourself, it's difficult to imagine anything, really. Now, you don't actually have to look at academic papers to see this effect. We're all quite familiar with it. I want to tell you about a particular thing. A few years ago, I went to a reading group, which was for people with various types of mental issues. A lot of them had very severe depression or anxiety, and they had come together to start a reading group, and I saw them several months in when it was already having effects. The particular meeting I went to was they were reading Wuthering Heights, the English novel, and had just got to this bit where Kathy, the heroine, had to decide between marrying either boring old Linton or this wildly exciting tempestuous chap Heathcliff. So I just want you to see what they had to say.
Every Linton on the face of the earth might melt into nothing before I could consent to forsake Heathcliff. Stop there and say, is this sort of state she's in something you'd aspire to? Would you like to be feeling what Catherine's feeling for somebody?
Definitely.
I'd love to feel it all the time, and I felt like that. You're like happy nearly all the time. It can last for weeks, months.
It is a beautiful idea in one way when she says, I am Heathcliff. In another way, you get the sense that it could be very, well, you know, dangerous as well, that sense that
she's marrying someone under false pretenses, really.
Mm. I can imagine it then from Linton's point of view. Imagine marrying Catherine, but then knowing that she's in love with somebody else.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he will find out.
I think deep down she should be with Heathcliff, isn't she?
Is he the one where she's sexually attracted to?
I think so, yes.
And the passion.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's who she should go for.
It did seem to me as I watched and listened to those people that this quite simple act of reading fiction had really changed their lives. And in fact, in one case, it actually saved a life. I know that, as you will probably see in the end. I'll come to it. Now, what the question that occurred to me was, what on earth is happening in people's brains to have this rather profound effect, this pastime? So I just want to go over a little bit of what is happening in the brain. You probably know that our brains are made up of neurons, electrical cells, and that they join together to form pathways which have electricity zapping back and forth endlessly. And that electricity, ebb and flow, is our thoughts, our emotions, and our feelings. Some of these pathways are pretty similar in all of us because they're actually built into our genes. Up here, on the left here, they're the pathways we all have, which take light from the eyes to the visual cortex at the back of our head. On the other side of the frame, you've got the connections between the two hemispheres of the brain, so that each side quite literally knows what the other is doing. Now, I just want to show you quickly the difference between speaking and reading, because they are very different. Speaking is something that, again, is in our genes. We already have those pathways wired into us when we are born. All you have to do is put a baby around people who are talking, and sooner or later they'll start to do it too. It's natural. But reading is not. You could put a baby in a library surrounded by books from the day it's born, and it would never start spontaneously reading. It has to be taught how to do it. And this is the reason speech has been with us for at least 100,000 years, quite time for natural selection to actually get it wired into our brains. But reading probably only started about 5,000 years ago, and until about 100 years ago, most people didn't do it at all. So rather than being able to use those pre-wired, intuitive, if you like, pathways, every person who learns to read has to do it afresh. And that means making new pathways, individual pathways, the sort that individuals do make all through their life. Every time they have an experience or lay down a memory or a new habit, they create individual pathways on top of the basic blueprint. And that's what we have to do when we read. Quickly, when you look at a brain that's speaking, it is fairly straightforward. The information, if you see a dog, say, information zooms to the back of the head, visual cortex, then it sort of chugs forward. As it chugs forward, it picks up memories of what it's looking at until by the time it gets to that blue area, which is the first of the major language areas, it is then able to put a word to it. And then it gets jogged on again to that next, the red area, Broca's, and that's where we remember how to say it. Quite literally, the motor area, which is that green stripe, is then instructed to send the instructions to our lips and our tongues to actually make the word. That's how speaking works. And as I say, it's natural. Those pathways are there already. But reading is a very different kettle of fish. When we see abstract symbols written down, our brain has to do far more work. It actually has to, when we're learning to read, we have to create all those new connections in many, many different parts of the brain. You can see the red bits are the lit up bits. You can see these aren't clear, easy, one-track pathways. These are really complicated networks that are being formed in the brain when we read. So your brain is doing a lot more work. It's connecting far more parts. If you like, it's a more holistic experience. It forces you to use parts of the brain that aren't usually used. More than that, the reason, or one reason why it's so widespread, is that when we read things about somebody doing something, they run for their life, or they're screaming, or they're frightened. What happens in the brain of the reader is that those same bits of the brain that would be active if they were doing it themselves become active, admittedly not quite to the same extent, or we'd act out everything we read. We can usually inhibit them enough not to do that. But basically, these are brain scans of people. You can see from the little color chart below, they're reading. The actual movement produces the pattern on your left. And when you're reading it, what is happening in your brain is the pattern on the right. And as you see, they are very similar, with the only difference being that when you read about things, it's not quite as intense. If it carried on in intensity, you would act it out. Because the important thing about reading is that you are not just learning what's going on in that person's head. You too, to a certain extent, are experiencing it. And there's a very big difference there. It's the same with everything with pain. If you watch or read about somebody in pain, you will, the same bits of the brain that will be active if you were feeling the pain, will become active as well. And some people feel this so much that they actually do feel and report the pain. Same with anger, same with any emotion, same even with quite complicated intellectual things like judgments, moral judgments and so on. Now, this is the new information, which has really only come out this year, which some researchers from Emory University in the States decided to see if they could actually see inside the brain what was going on. We know already from the earlier work that people become at least temporarily more sensitive to other people's feelings once they've read a book or been reading some fiction. And these researchers decided to set out to see if this was something that could actually be seen inside of the brain physically. So they had students, lots and lots, I think it was quite a large sample, reading a passage of, it was a particularly engaging and exciting novel with a lot of inside character driven stuff. It was actually Pompeii by Robert Harris, if you want to do the same for yourself. And they had the people read just 30 pages a night for 5 nights in a row. Now, they took brain scans before the people started doing this exercise to get a baseline of what their brains looked like before. Then they had them read, and every night after they had read a passage, they came in next morning, and they had their brain scanned again. And every day, there were differences. The differences, these are is a sort of schematic picture of where the differences were found, the connections, which, as the week went on, and they read a passage each night, they got thicker and denser. And they are, as you see, all over the brain, not just in the language areas, everywhere. Basically, what these people seemed to be doing was giving themselves a really good workout. In fact, the brain scans looked more or less what you would expect to find if these people had lived the events that they had been reading about. They had actually lived an experience, and it had become part of the architecture of their brain. So, in conclusion, I'm really giving the same message, I think, as Delia, the speaker before, which is that your brain needs a workout as much as your body. And reading fiction seems to be one of the best workouts you can get. And not only is it good for you, but it's also good for society as a whole, because the brain is like a muscle. The more you force yourself through books to take other people's perspectives, to sympathize, to empathize with other people, the more empathetic society we will have. Thank you.
Rita Carter discussing why reading matters here on the WHFR Journal. It comes from a TED Talk given last summer in Romania at a TEDx conference in Cluj, Romania. I'm Alan Mazurek, and on behalf of Susan McGraw, we want to thank you for being with us on the WHFR Journal. We hope you have a great weekend. Maybe spend some time and pick up a good book. Certainly something that any of us hopefully have the opportunity to do whenever we find the time. Anyway, Katie Love's going to be up next, taking us down Highway 61. We'll be back next Friday afternoon to do it all over again at 1 o'clock on the WHFR Journal. Have a great week.
Hey, this is the Gothabilly Man, your friendly neighborhood meatneck, Alan, of the Wrecking Hours Rockabilly, Psychabilly, and Surf Rock radio show, and I am a volunteer DJ.
Hi, this is Terrence Tyson of the Play It By Ear Jazz Show, and I am a volunteer DJ.
This is Lisa, the diva from Lyrical Infusion, and I am a volunteer DJ.
This is Jonathan, host of Songwriters Symposium. All of us here at WHFR volunteer to bring you the musical programming that you hear. Thank you for listening.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Time.